The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 20th, 2020. It is an emergency podcast because we have an emergency, which is tomorrow a Senate trial of the President of the United States sitting as a court of impeachment will commence. It actually formally commenced last week, but informally it was shunted off till Tuesday when both sides will begin to present arguments on the merits of the case as well as to fight over the procedural posture. Will we hear from witnesses? Will a motion to dismiss the whole thing shut it down relatively quickly? Both sides have submitted significant briefs over the weekend, and we are here to discuss it all. With me in the Jungle Studio is Margaret Taylor, Susan Hennessy, David Priest, and Scott Anderson. And joining us from Lawfare's Costa Rica Bureau is Paul Rosenzweig. So let's just get right into it. Margaret, get us started. Where are we procedurally when the Senate convenes tomorrow? What is the business it's going to have to do, and what should we expect at a sort of purely mechanical level we're going to be looking at tomorrow?
Right. So even though it is what we think, we're thinking of it kind of as the beginning of arguments, there will be arguments, just not quite from the House managers quite yet, because there will be, I think, significant arguments going on about how to organize the trial. In particular, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has indicated in the press and elsewhere that he is doing an organizing resolution that is modeled on the 1999, the Clinton impeachment resolution. But the difference this time around, though, is that there's not a lot of consensus on it. So back in 1999, it was a bipartisan resolution. It passed the Senate by unanimous consent, 100-0. This time around, the Democrats, nobody's even seen the text. It hasn't been released yet. Chuck Schumer, the minority leader, has been complaining that, you know, why is it so secretive? Why haven't we seen the text of this organizing resolution? What we do know about it from some press reporting is that it will provide for, we think, 24 hours of argumentation from the House managers and also from the president's defense team. One of the things that's very controversial is that it might have to happen over the course of 2 days. So that would essentially mean, you know, 12 hours of argumentation over 2 days, up to 24 hours. So that's going to be difficult, I think, for senators if that's what happens. There's also just going to be wrangling about the resolution itself and whether it passes. Senator McConnell has said he has the 51 votes to pass the resolution, but there could be amendments, you know, potential amendments that are offered by Democrats. There could be points of order offered on the resolution that could make for a heck of a lot of wrangling, I think, tomorrow.
All right. So you wrote a really interesting piece over the weekend that I want to pick your brain about, because I look at a resolution that says we're going to vote later about whether there are witnesses. And I look at the standing rules of the impeachment trial, which says nothing about voting later on whether there are going to be witnesses. And it looks to me like such a resolution would be a change in the rules, which would seem to, in my understanding, require 67 votes. McConnell seems to think he is going to pass such a resolution with only 51 votes. And I have great, great, great respect for McConnell as a master of the Senate. But I don't understand how this isn't a change in the rules. And so help me out. Why does McConnell only need 51 votes to pass a trial procedure that looks nothing like the trial procedure laid out in the Senate rules?
So I think one thing to keep in mind is that the procedures in an impeachment trial are just different from the sort of normal way the Senate works. And so I think everyone who purports to be sort of an expert in the Senate rule, which, by the way, I do not purport to be one of those people, but I am trying.
Despite having worked for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and having a certain intimacy with life under the Senate rules,
yes.
Notice that a real expert on Senate rules, one with actual experience like Margaret, never represents herself as an expert on Senate rules.
And it's the right way to go because, the Senate rules are complicated enough. When you put in the impeachment piece, it's like people's heads start to explode. But what I will say and what I wrote about is this. So back in 1999, as I said, the organizing resolution passed 100-0. So there was never this question of, well, is it a change to the Senate rules or is it not really? So it didn't really come up as far as I'm aware. This time around, though, it's contested. And so I do think that it would be possible for House Democrats to raise a point of order when McConnell tries to pass this to say, no, this, even though it doesn't like physically amend, like it doesn't say that Senate rules shall be amended this way and that way, they could argue that, substantively this does constrain and change the Senate rules. And in that instance, it would be up to the Chief Justice John Roberts to essentially make a ruling on it, or else, with presumably the advice of the Senate parliamentarian, or else put it to the body, put it to the senators themselves, and that vote would be at a 51 vote threshold.
So, are you expecting tomorrow to be not actual trial arguments, but arguments about the trial?
That is what I'm expecting. But if it goes on for, 12 hours, if McConnell has said, okay, we're just going to stay in and this is going to take a lot of hours, they could potentially get through all that stuff and then start the argumentation later in the day. But I do think early in the day, there's going to be this wrangling about the resolution. I suspect Democrats will try to offer amendments to the resolution. There's debate provided for on amendments to such a resolution. So it could be a lot of just stuff going on early on in the day, maybe getting to the argumentation later.
Okay, so when we do get to the argumentation, the president has a legal team, and that has occupied a fair bit of news over the last few days. Paul, I want to talk to you about this in particular because, as listeners know, you were an associate independent counsel under Ken Starr. You worked for him for a number of years, very closely. And you tweeted the other day in response to this news that you were depressed. And I want to just ask you about your depression about it and your reaction to Ken Starr taking on this role. We'll get to Bob Ray and Alan Dershowitz later.
Well, I guess I'm depressed because I don't understand how Judge Starr has wound up changing his mind. He must have changed his mind, of course, because back in 1999, when he recommended impeachment to the House of Representatives, his report recommended impeachment for a whole host of abuse of power offenses that are, well, not trivial, but certainly less substantial than those relating to President Trump. For example, in the 11th of the suggested articles that Judge Starr sent up, he said that the excessive invocation of executive privilege was itself an abuse of power. And he condemned President Clinton for not taking the high road as had President Carter and Reagan, of waiving all executive privilege. And he said that that was an impeachable offense. He said that President Clinton should be impeached for lying to the American public about his affair with Monica Lewinsky, as the president did in his very first set of public utterances. He said that President Clinton should be impeached for refusing six invitations to come to the grand jury, even though President Clinton ultimately came the seventh time and wound up, for example, giving his own blood. It strikes me as very difficult to understand why those acts by President Clinton were impeachable offenses and why directly cognate acts by President Trump today are not. And that's before we get to the criminality issues. So I have a hard time understanding what has happened and why standards have changed.
And Starr has insisted that there's no contradiction between his positions then and his positions now. I take it you don't find those protestations persuasive?
Well, I haven't, I haven't read, a lengthy summary of what he said or heard him speak to it directly. The one summary I read was a summary in which he said that, Bill Clinton was impeached for criminal conduct, which is true. The articles of impeachment that were eventually reported out involved both perjury and obstruction of justice allegations, which are very closely cognate to the same criminal charges. But that kind of elides what we were just discussing, which is that there were a host of other recommended grounds for impeachment that Judge Starr advanced that were not criminal in nature by any stretch of the imagination. So I haven't seen a detailed explanation from Judge Starr as to how to square that with what he's saying now.
So Starr is only one of three outside lawyers, I guess four, because Pam Bondi has also joined the team. Susan, you had some reactions to some of the others, particularly to Alan Dershowitz, and let's hold the Bob Ray thought for a moment, because that's a special case. But what is, other than he's been a kind of vociferous voice on behalf of the president on Fox News, has Alan Dershowitz been saying anything recently that sort of says to you this is a person who makes sense to represent the president?
I don't think so. I mean, I guess going on, the criteria by which President Trump selects these attorneys are some combination of people who go on Fox News to defend him and people who he thinks will maximally troll the libs. And so by that criteria, Alan Dershowitz is a fine choice, as is Ken Starr. They're both, I think, choices that while I think it's clear why the president wanted to make that choice, and it comports with his kind of reality show instincts of who might be representing him. I actually think it's something that's going to backfire for exactly the reason that Paul just talked about, especially for Ken Starr, but also for Alan Dershowitz. There's just hundreds and hundreds of hours of these people on the record taking contrary positions regarding impeachable conduct, contrary positions regarding the severity of Bill Clinton's abuse of power. And so every time any one of them files a brief or makes an argument, within an hour, we're going to have the side-by-side video clip showing sort of the pure hypocrisy. And so I think on that level, it was sort of a foolish strategic choice in the sense that it's only going to underscore the hypocrisy. I also think we have to think about this choice as, thinking about those four or five Republican senators who might ultimately join with the Democrats in order to demand things like witnesses, right? Sort of the procedure procedural unity, even though we don't actually think that they're actually going to vote to convict the president ultimately. Ken Starr and Alan Dershowitz don't seem like lawyers that are well designed to help Mitt Romney feel really comfortable with the good faith, integrity, and sort of technical underpinning of the constitutional arguments being offered. And so you could see Trump bringing in, you know, sort of a collection of attorneys or legal scholars that was going to lay out a constitutional argument that might not be all that different than what we're seeing in the president's brief this morning, but in a way that was going to make those senators, Susan Collins, Mitt Romney, Cory Gardner, kind of feel comfortable and as if they had cover in sticking by the president, even for conduct that they clearly find appalling, sort of saying, well, this is really about higher constitutional principles. And the problem with this particular selection and sort of the troll the libs quality of them is that it seems like those people are going to make those senators even less comfortable. And so that's why I think it's a little bit of a baffling choice as a strategic matter. Certainly there are better lawyers and better scholars to actually argue the merits here.
Okay, so I want to pose that question to David Priest, but I want to amplify it a little bit before I do. So Quinta Jurecic and I this morning in The Atlantic wrote a column that concludes by saying, hey, putting the senators in a difficult position here is actually part of the point, that this is a defense and a defense team that is designed to be a kind of middle finger at the impeachment process and consequently a loyalty oath demand of Republican senators, that, you know, we can put before you multiple lawyers who have deep reason for all the reasons that Susan says to make you experience cognitive dissonance. And when we do it, you're going to vote our way anyway, because the party gets to tell you that 2 + 2 = 5 and you snap to attention when you're told that. So, David, do you think that A, Susan is right, that it backfires because the cognitive dissonance is actually pretty extreme? Or is this hypothesis right? The cognitive dissonance is actually the point, and that is one of the mechanisms that the president has of exercising control over his party, is getting them to accede to frankly ridiculous propositions on their face.
I'm going to say that both can be true, that that could be the president's intent, even if not as well thought out as you and Quinta presented. But it could backfire. If that is the strategy, there's no reason to think that that strategy will succeed. A lot depends on something that we don't have a good assessment of, which is the backbone on this issue of somebody like Senator Romney, Senator Murkowski, Senator Collins. But it is risky for the reasons Susan pointed out. In fact, at the time of recording this, we already have Alan Dershowitz trying to square the circle. You have to remember that in our last impeachment, we did not have Twitter. So now we have a case where Alan Dershowitz this afternoon being faced with the side-by-side videos on CNN of him now saying there needs to be a crime to be an impeachment, and then 20 years ago him saying there does not need to be a crime to be an impeachment, is tweeting out, there is no inconsistency. I said then that there doesn't have to be a technical crime. I have said now that there must be criminal-like conduct. Well, that's not what the tape shows. And in fact, to the extent that people like Dershowitz are out there walking back some of their comments either direction, it gives some of those senators more reason to question some of the arguments that they will be hearing in the trial. So yes, the strategy could work. The strategy could backfire. Both are reasonable.
Okay, let's turn to the substance of these arguments. We have a brief filed, Saturday by the House managers. That is a roughly 35-page document with a lengthy appendix that is simply a count of the facts that the House managers want the Senate to accept. And then we have today a brief filed by intervening. We have a short document from the president's lawyers that is a kind of response to the articles of impeachment, roughly 6 pages. And then today we have a lengthy filing from the White House legal team that is the response to the House manager's brief. So, Scott, get us started. How would you characterize in broad strokes, and we'll get into the details, the argument between the two sides here?
Sure. I think the House's argument is about what we've come to expect. We've heard a version of this argument put forward numerous times. They point to official acts the president pursued for reasons they argue were for his personal benefit and notably were, if anything, detrimental to national interests, including election security and our foreign policy interests in Ukraine, and that he tried to use those official acts, specifically withholding a White House meeting and withholding foreign assistance to Ukraine, to secure an announcement of investigations by Ukrainian officials. On top of that, he also publicly indicated and directed federal officials not to participate in the impeachment inquiry, and according to the House, that constitutes obstruction of justice. So two charges, first being abuse of power for this effort to use as a public official capacity for his personal benefit, and then the obstruction of justice. The response today, the longer brief, and I'm going to skip over the shorter brief response, I think, because that really was more of a rhetorical document. It was a reiteration of a lot of these points saying that, oh, what the House has done was improper, was a violation of due process, was offensive to the president, the office of the president, without too much elaboration beyond the talking points you've seen the White House deploy. We did get elaboration on that from the today in this longer brief, about 110-page brief with a couple of appendices, including some new OLC opinions, Office of Legal Counsel opinions for the Justice Department. And what the president basically argues is this. He says, well, abuse of power isn't really an impeachable offense, at least not as the House has construed it. They say essentially the House is essentially making any sort of conduct impeachable if we do it for the wrong subjective motives, and that really blows the doors open on what impeachment can be. It really does try and lump this into this idea of what maladministration, which is a category of offense that the Founding Fathers decided not to include in the impeachment power, in part because of separation of powers concerns and concerns that it was too open-ended. And they say this falls into that trap. And the obstruction of justice claim, it's a little more interesting. They rely very heavily upon two prior OLC opinions, one regarding testimony that we've seen before, one regarding testimony by federal officials without agency counsel present, another one talking about testimony by key advisors to the president. And then they rely on a third OLC opinion that was written just January 19th, that's included as Appendix C of this brief that we got today, which makes actually, I think, probably the most important part of their obstruction argument. It says categorically that the subpoenas the House issued were invalid because essentially it argues that the House, under its long-established practice, under its own rules, has to expressly authorize an impeachment inquiry before any subpoenas can be issued under the impeachment power. And it says that the House didn't do that here when it issued these subpoenas initially, which is true. H.R. 660 came after most of the subpoenas were initially issued. But then it says further, it says, well, H.R. 660 didn't expressly ratify those prior subpoenas, and therefore it did not cure the prior invalidity, and none of the subpoenas therefore have the power of law. The reason I say that's the most important part, I think, of their obstruction defense, frankly, is because the prior two arguments about the lack of agency counsel and senior advisors, those don't get you to the point where you can say, as the president, categorically directing the federal government not to participate with the impeachment inquiry, or at least to respond to any subpoenas. This new argument does, if they think it's right. I think it's flawed for reasons we can discuss. But if nothing else, it does do this work of trying to knock out all the subpoenas.
Okay, but help me out on this, Scott, and tell me if I'm missing something or just being unfair, right? There's something that's profoundly circular about this argument, right? So the argument is that the president's failure to comply with subpoenas, which become the basis of the obstruction of Congress charge, that actually is the reason why they impeach him, that because the impeachment didn't come first, therefore the subpoenas, which were issued before the impeachment and were the basis of the impeachable conduct, that renders the subpoenas defective in retrospect, and is the White House now saying that if the House says, okay, let's press pause and reissues the subpoenas now, that they're prepared to comply with them? I mean, it just seems like such a preposterous bad faith argument that the idea that they really expect the Senate or the public to buy that no, this wasn't about the president going on television and saying, we're refusing all subpoenas. We aren't going to produce any documents. We aren't going to produce any testimony. But this was really about the failure to ratify, the pre-existing subpoenas in this House resolution. It just strikes me as a fundamentally absurd.
And one additional question. The House of Representatives issues subpoenas to the executive branch outside of the context of impeachment inquiries all the time. Why is a subpoena issued by the House Intelligence Committee or the House Judiciary Committee investigating stuff that may or may not end up being related to an impeachment? Why is that presumptively defective absent a resolution specifically authorizing it?
I think those are both really good questions, and they're great ways to illustrate what the OLC has done and what the White House's lawyers are doing with that opinion. To go Ben's questions first, really what they essentially are saying, they acknowledge that the House committees right now under the House rules have authorization to issue subpoenas for a variety of purposes, but those are all for legislative purposes according to them, and they have a constrained vision of that. We've seen this in other OLC opinions. This is new to this White House, not new to the Trump administration in this opinion. But more importantly here, they say, well, all these subpoenas, even though some of them did reference oversight authority, they say, well, but they all talk about impeachment. And they're all clearly aimed towards impeachment. And they can't just use the oversight authority to get around the limitations of the impeachment power, which they say requires this advance authorizing resolution. Susan, for your question, their point hinges on this idea of an authorizing resolution, not the actual impeachment itself. So that's H.R. 660, which said, all our committees can continue their investigation, and it set up rules for kind of ranking members to ask subpoenas and issue subpoenas and things like that. The problem that it has here is that you can accept that argument on the front end, perhaps. Like, you can say, well, maybe the House does need to authorize these things more expressly and directly. I'm not saying I do, but okay, let's accept that. It still has to wrestle with H.R. 660, right? The House did do that. It did come in and say, we approve all these investigations. We support them. And this is how it gets around it. And this is why I think is so problematic about that. It says, well, it wasn't express enough in doing so. The H.R. 660, the language says it directs the House committees to continue their investigatory activities relating to impeachment, something like that, paraphrasing, but just uses that directs them to an investigations language. They say essentially, no, it needed to expressly ratify these sorts of subpoenas. This is a rule that doesn't come from anywhere. It's particularly strange in my mind to be applying this to House rules, which is usually an area where the courts have traditionally said this is really up for the Congress itself to patrol. And here, I think the most interesting part about this is H.R. 660 also never expressly authorized the majority to issue subpoenas at all. It only expressly discusses subpoenas by the ranking members. So if you read it by that logic, OLC's opinion, maybe H.R. 660 only authorized Nunes to issue subpoenas, not necessarily, Schiff and the other majorities in the committees.
Don't tell that to Nunes.
So it's a problematic reading, to say the least, but it's by these sorts of technical manipulations of these languages and these very demanding, strict rules that they get to this outcome they want, which is to invalidate these subpoenas.
Okay, so Margaret, we have dove down in the weeds of one particular argument, but let's zoom back out and say, like, what is the basic argument that the president is making in his defense in this brief?
Yeah, so Scott, your explanation was very sort of elegant and I think sort of generous. When I read it, to me it reads like just a kitchen sink approach to this defense. It's got all the rhetoric that we've heard from House Republicans and from President Trump himself. It talks about how this is just House Democrats' partisan obsessions. It says there's a requirement for a violation of established law, which is a very controversial assertion, that there must be a beyond a reasonable doubt standard, that the Senate can only, use information and allegations in the House articles and conduct found by the House, nothing outside or additional. There's a sort of a freestanding due process requirement here. It was entirely appropriate and proper for the president to request these investigations into the Biden's embrace. But I could go on and on and on. But it reads like that. It is a kitchen sink approach. And it strikes me that President Trump must be very, very pleased with this approach. It gives no ground on anything, admits nothing, denies everything and counterattacks, essentially. And that is, you know, as we know, President Trump's preferred approach on things, that having been Roger Stone's approach and Roy Cohn's approach. So, you know, it is not, I'd say, a particularly elegant document or necessarily a strategic document beyond that, you know, very sort of broad approach. So that's how it struck me.
Paul, how did it strike you?
I was struck very much by what I would characterize as the overbreath of it, which is to say that at its maximum, if you take the president's argument seriously, then the following things are all true. The president cannot be indicted for a crime while he is in office. The president cannot be investigated for a crime by anybody other than perhaps the Department of Justice that works for him, i.e. not by the state of New York, at least for as long as he's in office. The president cannot be called to account for anything impeachment that isn't a crime itself. But of course, if that's not investigable or indictable, it's difficult to understand how the House would get to that place anymore. More to the point, the president is free to conduct all manner of hypothetical abuses of the office that are not criminal in nature, that can and should remain within his purview. You know, the internet is alive, awash with strange hypotheticals. My favorite is that if President, at least under, as I read President Trump's theory, if he promised to pardon anybody who murdered Joe Biden, that would not itself be an impeachable offense. So what really struck me, I very much agree with both Scott and Margaret that this is a hyper-technical argument, and it is also one that's designed to meet the president's own interest in counterpunching. But what really struck me is that if we actually accept any version of this as the grounds for declining to remove the president, if in conducting its affairs the Senate in any way accepts not just the result but the argument that the president is advancing, we will have gone a very long way towards undermining the system of checks and balances in a way that seems to me almost irreparable.
Yeah, so I think Paul has put his finger on a really, really critical point that sort of ties together what we saw in the Mueller investigation and the president's sort of legal assertions then and what we're seeing now. And that's this notion of a defined violation of criminal law or of statutory law. So one of the big questions that sort of whenever the Ukraine scandal kind of first erupted was whether or not this was a violation of campaign finance law, right? So whenever the, Assistant Attorney General for National Security saw this call transcript, he went and told the head of the criminal division. In the government, we often call that a crimes report process. Whenever one lawyer looks at something and says, this is outside my jurisdiction, but I believe it may represent a crime, and I'm going to pass it over. And then the Assistant Attorney General for the criminal division put his fingers in his ear, said, la, 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 a foreign government's investigation cannot ever be a thing of value for any purposes under campaign finance law. We're done, you know, don't even start with me. You know, I saw what happened to all those other people who went down this path. That's just one person. That's not even an OLC opinion. That's one guy in the Trump administration deciding essentially unilaterally that this wasn't a criminal violation and he wasn't going to investigate it. So this theory that the Trump administration is putting on the table is that his own Justice Department, which the president controls as a unitary matter, is allowed to define what is and is not criminal conduct in the first instance, and more importantly, what is and is not criminal conduct by the president of the United States in the first instance. And that, to me, is really an astonishing sleight of hand trick, because the House and the Senate could certainly turn around and say, well, we're going to go back to the drawing board. There are multiple violations of both criminal and civil law that we could say are violated here.
So, David, one of the striking things about this argument is that it seems to me to fly in the face of not merely some, but the vast majority of the history of impeachment, at least as measured by things Congress has actually impeached people for. And we just ran a piece by Hillary Hurd, which lays out a bunch of the sort of history of things that Congress has actually impeached people for, which include, you know, taking the Lord's name in vain on the bench and being a little tipsy sometimes on the bench and staying on the bench when your state secedes and refusing to resign, none of which is criminal activity. And so my question is, as you understand the sort of de facto history of like what is an impeachable offense in practice, how ahistorical is this argument?
The argument, we could break it down in two ways. The first thing that they do, they actually disarm your main point, which is look at all of these judges who have been impeached for being drunk on the bench or for just being really rough personalities. They make the point, well, you can't really hold up judicial impeachments as the same as presidential because there has to be good behavior.
And wait, let me just flag that, because the standard in the Constitution for judicial impeachment is exactly the same standard as for a president. The president, the vice president, and all civil officers shall be impeached by the House of Representatives and removed by the Senate for treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. Where do they get this idea that there's a different standard?
Absolutely. I said it was an argument. I did not say it was a convincing argument. They try to make the case that judges are supposed to be serving in good behavior, whereas the president does not have a similar phrase. Of course, the president takes an oath, which implies very much the same. So I think that argument tends to fall apart. But they do at least recognize that, and they try to say most of these cases, and I say most for a very good reason, most of these cases that people could cite saying things less than crimes are impeachable are judicial. But they forget one, and they forget it twice in their argument. They write, until now, the House of Representatives has never, and of course they have to put that in bold italics to make it sound presidential, has never impeached a president of the United States without alleging a violation of law. They even walk through the attempted impeachment of Andrew Johnson in 1867, which did not get a House majority and therefore was not an impeachment. And then they let it go with a quick line of course, Congress did not impeach Johnson until he violated the Tenure of Office Act. But the actual articles of impeachment against Johnson were not all limited to the violation of the Tenure of Office Act. In fact, President Johnson was impeached for saying mean things about Congress. Their actual words, he was impeached for attempting to bring into disgrace, ridicule, hatred, contempt, and reproach the Congress of the United States. That is clearly not a crime, and that is what Andrew Johnson was impeached for. He also happens to have been impeached for violating the Tenure of Office Act.
So, but it's worse than that, because Richard Nixon, who of course was not ultimately impeached, but one of the articles of impeachment again that the Judiciary Committee approved was for abuse of power, for not, you know, for, you know, misusing your authority as president, right?
It was effectively an abuse of power, and that is what it's characterized at. The language within that article that the Judiciary Committee passed against Richard Nixon did include claims of illegality, and that is what this brief is hooking onto, is saying, but even when they talked about abuse of power, it was because he committed specific illegal acts.
Sure. On the other hand, this set of allegations includes, does it not, Margaret, allegations that effectively amount to running an extortion racket against a foreign country. They just call it abuse of power.
Yeah, and, you know, I will also just point out that in the House report, there is discussion of bribery and sort of criminal offenses as well. It didn't actually get into the articles of impeachment for various reasons, but, and I think the reason was, like, the House didn't want to be wrangling about, you know, well, does this meet the statutory definition of bribery and all of that? Like, they wanted to sort of avoid all of that by focusing more on this abuse of power argument. But I agree, like, and with Susan and everyone, like, there's criminality sort of around this, but because of the way There's been like a shell put around the president, and so it's hard to talk about the president and criminality now because of this, these opinions that he can't be prosecuted criminally. You know, some people, I think like Bill Barr, think he shouldn't even really have been investigated. So in the context of the Mueller investigation, so, you know, it's just, it's there. The elements of criminality are there. They're just not in, as you say, it's not, they don't use those words in the articles of impeachment.
Yeah, and just one small gloss on that, I think is an interesting kind of omission in the White House's arguments here, is their argument actually isn't that it has to be a criminal act. They say it has to be a violation of the law. And then it says, indeed, even a crime at one point. So it's a little ambiguous about what sort of violation we're talking about. And here, even if you don't buy that this could amount to extortion or bribery, although certainly it looks a lot like those in a lot of different ways, there's a much more concrete alleged violation here, which is the Budget Impoundment Act, Impoundment Control Act, which we have an opinion from GAO saying that we think this law was in fact violated, perhaps knowingly. That they don't address that here. I suspect we may see a more focus on that once we see the House's reply brief, as it's a clear kind of hole in their defense.
Yeah, I also think it's worth noting the idea that any kind of criminal violation or violation of the law is necessary is plainly wrong. So I think it was like 2 years ago that we published, maybe even longer, we republished the very famous Charles Black chapter on the impeachable offense. And I think he disproves, right? He disproves the idea that a criminal violation is provided in one paragraph, two sentences. Suppose a president were to move to Saudi Arabia so he could have four wives and were proposed to conduct the office of the presidency by mail and wireless from there. This would not be a crime provided his passport were in order. Is it possible that such a gross and wanton neglect of duty could not be grounds for impeachment and removal? It's an absurd position on its face. And so the mere fact that we are wrangling over the technicalities and have taken the bait by virtue of it also being wrong on the merits, I think it's worth just noting, BS, you're just making that up.
I just want to say that Charles Black quote, which is very dear to my heart, has within it the piece of evidence of what a spectacular lawyer Charles Black was, which is the inclusion of the phrase, provided his passport was in order. All right, so Paul, all of this raises the question in my mind as to whether the House articles are at some level misplayed. That is, has the House packaged this material in a way that gives rise to vulnerability to some of these arguments? Or is this just, as Margaret was saying, the president sort of throwing the kitchen sink? These arguments don't really have merit. And they're, you know, this is however they organized this set of articles would have had some variation of this particular package of responses. Should they have said the word bribery? Should they have packaged it differently, or wouldn't it have made a difference?
Well, can I take David's answer and say a little bit of both? The articles of impeachment are based, I think, on the art of the possible within the House of Representatives. Had it been me and given free rein, I'd have thrown the kitchen sink at Trump in the first instance. I'd have included the obstruction of justice in the Mueller report, for example. I'd have included the violation of campaign finance law in order to cheat to become to become president of the United States. I certainly would have particularized each of his abuses of power, to a greater degree. I would have called it bribery because that's what it is. It's the solicitation of a thing of value for personal benefit conditioned upon the withholding of an official act, and it meets the definition pretty clearly. That having been said, I tend to agree with Margaret that nothing would have prevented the president's lawyers from essentially mounting a we can't be convicted defense, no matter what they did, no matter what the House did. So I don't find any real ground for critiquing the House's choice of how to construct the articles of impeachment, because I don't think it would have affected the president's response. I agree completely with Susan that it seems a little ludicrous to me that we're actually treating Dershowitz as if he's serious and having devoted 10 minutes of our time to it, much less letting him appear on TV and make this point when he's clearly around the bend. But, I guess that's where we are in America today. It says more about the inadequacy of our ability to comprehend the depths to which Trump has taken us than it does about the punctiliousness or lack thereof in the House's
David
drafting
Priest?
Of the articles.
Yeah, there's one thing that I see in the House manager's brief that, frankly, as I read it, I thought, this is giving an easy one to the president's attorneys and to his defense. Not that it's wrong, but that it's one of these is not like the other when it comes to the rest of this very tightly argued, very specific brief. And that's the section on President Trump jeopardizing U.S. national interests. Now, that's necessary for the context of why this act done for personal political reasons was wrong. But in arguing, essentially, his conduct is alarming because it endangered U.S. national security. It undermined our efforts to promote the rule of law globally. Well, those are largely presidential prerogatives. So it's useful for context, but this was not going to be an area that even the best legal team was going to overlook because they rightfully, in their counterbrief, say, you're reaching too far if you think that's impeachable because you disagree about policy.
I agree with you on that, David, a little bit. But I will say I think the House does a little more sophisticated job and, frankly, maybe should shift tack to take a little different approach to that there. They do spend a fair amount of time trying to weigh the different interests, arguing, well, this is in the policy interest, this isn't. And that is difficult terrain. Foreign policy is an area where the president gets a lot of deference in determining interest in most contexts. It doesn't necessarily apply in impeachment, but there's a bit of a sense that he has a lot of control here, even though I think it's often overstated. But there's lots of other indicators that are in the House brief that they can play up, and I think they may want to turn to. A big one here is just the process that led to this decision, the fact that the president pursued this through regular channels without consulting with experts or policymakers, did none of the due diligence that we expect presidents and policymakers to pursue in order to make decisions in the national interest. And we saw none of that here. And personally, I would have liked to see and hope to see more of that coming forward in the House argument. It also, frankly, is something that really redoubles the argument as to why we should hear testimony from John Bolton and other people who are firsthand witnesses to how the president made his decision. And how he made that decision is a great indicator of the state of mind and intent that he approached it with. And that's the real issue here.
All right. So let us take that. We've kind of come backhandedly to evaluation of the House manager's brief. But Margaret, I got to say, I was pretty impressed with this brief. I expected I don't know why, but I expected, maybe because I don't think of members of the House as especially good lawyers.
The soft bigotry of low expectations.
Yes, so it may have been the soft bigotry of low expectations, except that, in fact, we've known for a while that the lawyers that the Intelligence Committee majority has had working on this are very capable. And I actually think Steve Castor did a better job for the minority than some people think he did. That said, I found this brief to be a genuinely cogent and, for the most part, with a couple of minor exceptions, very accurate account of the record and a quite persuasive argument, David and Scott's point notwithstanding, that actually conviction is merited on both counts. Margaret, I noticed you tweeted yesterday that you were reading it and found it fun, I think was what you said, or something like that.
Strangely
or pleasure,
relaxing.
Pleasurable
enjoyable.
Read or something.
Yeah.
Critique it. How'd they do?
So I did find it easy to read. I found it coherent. They made their arguments. And so, reading through it, it is easy to read. It is the story we have been hearing. And I think for me, it kind of goes back to, what is the narrative of this thing? What is the narrative of what House managers and the House trying to say about what, about President Trump's actions here? And it's a pretty coherent story that they tell through their brief. Contrast that, in my view, to this sort of very disjointed, as I said before, kitchen sink kind of a legalistic approach in the president's trial brief. And to me, what it says is the narrative the sort of factual narrative and narrative that the House managers have put around what the president has done here, to me, is much more, it makes sense. But the president's trial brief, it's all over the place. And it's no mystery that Mitch McConnell would want to sort of have this be happening in the middle of the night, perhaps, because the narratives are just so different. And I think the president's sort of narrative on this, if it takes a factually based approach, is going to just be disjointed and weird.
Okay, so Susan, I want to try to distill this in the last few minutes of this to what we can say about the trial strategies of the two sides. One side presents a pretty factually tight, pretty organized, pretty simple brief. The other side amasses a legal team that sends a statement, makes a statement. It's a somewhat odd statement, as we've discussed, and presents a kind of all over the place brief that is conditioned, among other things, by the forbidding of these lawyers to give any ground, right? Because the president's position is the call was perfect. You can't say, oh, it was not a good thing, but it wasn't impeachable, right? And so my question is, what can we conclude from these presentations about the two sides before the Senate as we go into this trial? What are they trying to achieve, given that we know what the outcome is going to be?
Given that we know what the outcome is going to be, I think that the House impeachment manager's job is to lay out the degree of evidence and the clarity of what we know about the president's misconduct, and lay that bare before the American people, and make the choice of Senate Republicans as clear and painful as possible. And ultimately, what will be success is if at the end of all of this, even as those Republicans sort of hang their heads in shame and vote to acquit, that there is no ground for them to hide behind. There's no ambiguity in which they can say, well, you didn't prove this case or there was this element, and they have to hide behind essentially an argument, whether you want to call it a constitutional argument or not, that this is acceptable, that it's not impeachable. Because the president's legal strategy really is, he didn't do it, and so what if he did? And so I think the House impeachment manager's job is to get rid of this, he didn't do it. Because this is not really something on which reasonable minds can differ about what happened. The real question and the real issue before the Senate is, so what if he did? And that, you know, that's going to be significant in the upcoming election. It's going to be significant as new information comes out, right? We've got Lev Parnas with these document dumps. We've got John Bolton, who's got a tell-all coming out and is, you know, itching to tell his story. And so the idea that this is sort of the end of it, that's just not sort of plausible to me. The president's attorneys can, you know, throw a lot of sort of smoke in the air, and in some ways they're assured their outcome and they're sort of assured their victory from the beginning. But I think the actual game here is, you know, really making them concede the facts, giving that sort of clarity to the public about, hey, this is what happened, and this is what the president admits happened. And Senate Republicans think that this is all A-OK. And is it OK with you? And is it OK with you when you pick a president in November? And is it OK with you when you decide who to vote for Senate and whether or not you are going to reelect people? And I think that's the whole game.
And the House managers made that explicit when they ended their executive summary with, history will judge each senator's willingness to rise above partisan differences, view the facts honestly, and defend the Constitution. They're not writing this for the American people, who aren't going to read all of this. They're trying to reach the senators and their staffs who do read this and say, look, this is for you. if they can get what they failed to get in the House, which is one Republican vote for conviction, this becomes a bipartisan impeachment trial to that extent, even if they don't get to 51, even if, of course, they don't get to 67. I think that's the audience they're shooting for, and Susan just nailed it.
Scott, what is, as you understand it, the president's strategic objective here? He's got enough votes to get him acquitted. What is the purpose of these arguments?
From the perspective of the president, and I think he is the audience that these lawyers are trying to respond to, even if, I think they do have legal arguments underlying here that are a little bit more credible, although ultimately flawed. But a lot of the kitchen sink approach that I think Margaret ably described throughout the brief is responding to the president's demands. And the president wants complete vindication on every front. We hear that in every letter, every note he sends to Pelosi, screaming how innocent he is. And that's the goal here that they're reaching towards. I think the dangerous thing, though, is the choice that's presenting the Senate, frankly, particularly Senate Republicans with. They're under immense political pressure to vindicate him. If this really is the loyalty test, I think, as you and Quinta have kind of argued that it is, and I think there's a persuasive case for that. That's certainly how the president sees it. To get to this outcome that the president wants, these lawyers have argued for an incredibly constrained scope of congressional authority, particularly around impeachment. And they haven't contested the facts, really, particularly around the abuse of power offense. That means that if you really vote to vindicate the president, it's hard not to reach the conclusion that this is a precedent for the idea that the Senate, at least at this moment, believes that its ability to impeach the president is extremely limited. And that's something that, if there's any vestige of institutional interest left in Republicans in the Senate, I think they'd be hesitant to fully embrace. And I'll be curious if they try and find a way to split the hair a little bit and walk back from some of the legal conclusions, even while still ultimately acquitting the president. But it's going to be difficult because they don't really give them much room to do that with.
Margaret, I'm going to give you the last word here. I want to add something to Susan's account of the president's defenses. I didn't do it. And so what if I did? I actually think there's a third dimension to the defense, which is I didn't do it, so what if I did? And the Democrats really suck. And so what do you have when the Senate confronts a set of House managers making this argument that they're making, this kind of organized on count one, here's the evidence, on count two, this very kind of tightly argued presentation. And on the other hand, you have a, I didn't do it, so what if I did, and they suck kind of defense. And by the way, the impeachment power is really constrained and you can't really impeach me for anything. What do you have when those two arguments crash into each other in the form of a Senate trial? It's all on you.
Chaos. just to back up a little bit, I mean, I do think that when I read the president's trial brief, what I saw it as is it's giving all of these different arguments and factual and legal and everything. It's giving something to everyone. If you're a Senate Republican and you want to hang your hat on, the subpoena was invalid, you can hang your hat on that. If you want to hang your hat on, I really think there should be a crime before or a violation of established law. It's giving everybody a menu of what, to choose from about what they are going to use as their justification for acquittal. And that is something that we have seen from Trump all along. He kind of puts all the arguments out there, and he maybe even contradicts himself on all these issues. But all his different constituencies around Washington and around the country, they're able to sort of pick and choose and justify the outcome based on all these options that he has given. And I think that is a fundamentally bad place for the country to be in, because it eviscerates the idea that we can all come together around a shared set of facts and decide whether we think actions by our president and by our political leaders are okay with us or not. It makes it just extremely difficult, I think, actually, for voters to come around and really understand what's happening. And it's, to my mind, a variation of kind of a disinformation campaign. So that's what I think it basically means. And I find it personally to be disturbing.
On that cheerful note, we are going to wrap up. But before we do, I want to announce a new podcast project, which germinated last week as we realized we were really heading into this trial. We have decided to revive the Report podcast feed and use it to put together a daily digest or distillation, kind of like our No Bull podcasts on this feed with congressional testimony, but probably more condensed, and just a daily presentation that tells the story of that day's goings-on in the trial. We're calling it the impeachment, and it will be on the Report feed starting tomorrow, which is to say Tuesday, and will occur every day that there is a Senate trial, at least as long as people are listening to it. This has been more than that, we don't know, so don't ask me, because, you know, we're going to make this one up as we go along. This has been a emergency edition, special edition of the Lawfare podcast. Thanks to our Costa Rica Bureau, Paul Rosenzweig, to Scott Anderson, David Priest, Susan Hennessy, and Margaret Taylor in the Jungle Studio. Our audio engineer for this episode is the long-suffering Jacob Schultz. We don't have music on the Lawfare podcast emergency editions because it's an emergency. You don't have time to put in the music. But if we did, it would be performed by Sophia Yan. You can still, however, buy merch on emergency editions of the Lawfare podcast. And you know you want to. So go to thelawfarestore.com. Of course, share the Lawfare podcast on whatever social media you use. I'm particularly disappointed with our Pinterest presence, and I want you to fix that. I also think there haven't been enough Lawfare TikTok videos, so get on that, people. And I want you to leave us a rating and review in whatever podcast distribution service you got us from. And that is enough from me. Thanks for listening.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.